Alban Berg's violin concerto dedicated to the memory of the 18-year-old Manon Gropius, whose death had devastated her family and friends, Berg amongst them. Played at the Proms tonight by Gil Shaham and the Minnesota Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska. And Brian Newhouse has been sitting next to me listening to that performance. And Brian, I don't think you'd ever guess that Gil Shaham had so little rehearsal with the orchestra prior to this morning.
Well, Lisa Batyashvili was to have been the soloist, and she took ill, and Gil was tapped at the very last minute. And travel snafus that anybody can recognize is pretty much standard operating procedure these days. So he missed all sorts of rehearsal, and they had to put this together on very short notice. And the only clue you would get of that was the length of the embrace between Osmo Vanska and Gil Shaham right there.
A very, very warm embrace at the end.
I think they were both saying, phew, we made it.
But watching them at rehearsal was fascinating, particularly, as I was saying before, the care that they were taking over this. And I mean, after the official bit of this rehearsal was over, Gil Shaham and Osmo Vanska both stayed behind, and they were giving a little sort of private masterclass to the woodwind section with that wonderful Bach chorale in the final piece of the work to make sure they just got it absolutely right.
It doesn't surprise me at all. I noticed as I was watching Osmo conduct, when the Bach chorale came in, you really hear it in the clarinets. And he just paid such close attention to the clarinets, because he himself was a clarinetist. And you could just tell, I know exactly how to do this, and I know the care with which this has to be done, because this is the crux of this music. And it was just such a haunting moment there.
And the players, of course, you know, they wanted to get it right just as much as everybody, and they were prepared to put in that work and stay behind, which I guess is part of that whole chamber music ethos that Osmo was talking about earlier.
Yeah, he refuses to let any I be undaunted and any T be uncrossed. That is his nature, with the way he just takes such a fine-tooth comb through the score all the time. I've seen this time and time again in rehearsal when players are tired, they would like to do something else, let's move on. And no, he won't let them. And here comes Mr. Gil Shaham back on
the
stage.
You can hear all that stamping, and we're going to be quiet now, because we're going to have a bit more, I think.
Let's hope so. We hope we get an encore from
Mr. Shaham. He's got the violin, so.
Saraband and Double by Bach.
a solo encore from Gil Shaham, the Sarabande and double from Bach's B minor partita. And Brian, not only perfectly chosen, but also I think it's one of those proms moments when you could hear a pin drop and actually you feel as though you're sitting in your own living room instead of in this huge hall with thousands of people.
Exactly. We've got 5,500 people here and I did not hear a shoe squeak. I didn't hear a single peep, not a cough, not a sniffle, which is something because it was pouring rain and a lot of people came in here kind of damp right before the concert.
Very stoical, yes. The queue of promos has been very stoical today. It's been fine for most of the day and then the heavens opened just before the concert started.
Another bow for Gil Shaham.
Yeah, and I should say that the BBC Symphony Chorus, you were remarking before that they're all on stage as well. They're not really needed till part two. But they took the decision to come on to enjoy this first half.
Well, that is actually very surprising to me as an American to see the chorus, which isn't going to be necessary for another 45 minutes. They've been sitting out in the choral seats just to enjoy the concert. You just don't see that in the States.
Yep, and adding to the applause here in the hall. And in fact, quite a few people had got up after the beg, thinking it was the interval and just stayed hanging around in the aisles to listen to that fantastic encore.
And they got a treat, didn't they?
Absolutely. Well, the chorus now are making their way off stage, but they will be back again in part two because the Minnesota Orchestra will return with Osmo Vanska to perform Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with, as I said, the BBC Symphony Chorus and four soloists. I'll be talking to Brian again about that after the interval, but during that interval, it's time to hop over the road for more of this year's Proms Literary Festival with Rana Mitter.
Welcome to the Proms Literary Festival, our summer-long series of events held here at the Royal College of Music. And tonight, even more than usual, we're all about joy. Tonight's prom features Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and its triumphant last movement sets to music one of the most passionate explosions of pleasure in Western literature, Friedrich Schiller's Ode to Joy. Schiller was an 18th century man of parts, playwright, essayist, and disciple of Goethe. He embraced the Enlightenment with both hands, writing philosophy that grappled with rationality by drawing on Immanuel Kant, and then giving an airing to revolution with plays such as William Tell and Don Carlos, resulting in his reputation as Germany's greatest classical playwright. But of all of his work, it may be his great poem of 1785 that's been best remembered. Schiller wrote the ode in the aftermath of the American Revolution, but this celebration of universal brotherhood inspired Beethoven to set it to music after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. And it's been an anthem for revolutionary optimism and brotherhood ever since then. And my guests today are quite a brotherhood in their own right. Singer-songwriter Billy Bragg knows something about revolutionary optimism. His anthems such as New England have always linked the personal and the radical. Playwright Peter Oswalt has had more than a brotherly relationship with Schiller. His 2005 play Mary Stuart drew on the German original and was a big hit on the London stage. And poet David Constantine surely knows his Sturm from his Drang. Amongst his current projects is a new translation of Goethe's Faust. Would you please welcome them all? David, you're an expert translator from the German. I wonder, David, if you might read us just a little bit of Schiller's original Ode to Joy and then translate it for us.
The poem is in regular trochaic rhyming, heavily fully rhyming verses of 8 lines and then a chorus of 4. Freude, schöne Güterfunken, Tochter aus Elysium, wir betreten feuertrunken, himmlische, dein Heiligtum. Deine Zauber binden wieder, was der Modeschwert geteilt. Bettler werden Fürstenbrüder, wo dein sanfter Flügel weilt. That line, Bettler werden Fürstenbrüder, is what Schiller first wrote. Beggars will become the brothers of princes. You could say toned it down into what the line that we now know. Alle Menschen werden Brüder, all men will become brothers, which is the great cry for fraternity. You can hear, I think, as I read it, just it's heavily rhythmical. The rhymes are very full, and it lends itself. It's the only one, really, of Schiller's poems that got set. It got set immediately. There were four Bikerner that Peter's mentioned, and there have been over 100 since. But Schiller does not enter the canon of German Lieder. This is really the only one.
But let's be clear with that line, David. I mean, there's a real radical political agenda going on there. All beggars will be brothers too. Is this a good piece of lyrical construction?
Well, the trouble with the Ode to Joy in its original form, it's very flowery. You know, the imagery that Schiller is using is really the imagery from the Romantic period. And what Schiller is referring to is now, I think, what we would refer to as the European Enlightenment, which in itself was a revolutionary idea. You know, it was as the scientists were trying to make a rational shape to the world and look at universal forces such as gravity. So there were people like Tom Paine, like Voltaire, like Schiller, who were trying to find a universal humanity. And in some ways, the Ode to Joy, when matched with Beethoven's orchestration, to me, becomes the hymn of the European Enlightenment.
And Peter, you're someone who's engaged in great detail with Schiller's plays as a playwright yourself. Do you find something in the Ode to Joy that helps you rework Schiller in English for a 21st century generation?
While he's being political, he's also being spiritual, and it's maybe that which Beethoven picked up on, that he's actually saying right in those first early lines that the modes of the world have divided people, and what is needed to bring people back together is what he calls this Gotterfunken, this divine spirit. So, and then in the rest of the poem, it's about 108 lines.
Could we focus on one word, actually, rather than 108 lines, Peter, which is the word Freude, joy, that sits there right at the centre of the poem.
Yeah.
Now, we translate it into English as joy. Does that capture what's important about this term?
No, I don't think it does at all. I think joy is a very weak translation of Freude. And Freude is nearer to something like ecstasy, passionate ecstasy. And when he links it, as I say, with this divine force, then it becomes something very different from what in English we would probably associate with joy.
Joy for the Romantics, for Wordsworth and for Coleridge and for Blake and for Claire, actually, Claire despite his circumstances, was a colossal concept.
Yeah.
And Coleridge in the Ode to Dejection, when he says, "Oh lady, we receive but what we give, and what we receive and we get back what we give," he is actually talking about joy. And the Ode to Dejection is the loss of joy. So it is the enlivening force, I think.
If you're trying to write a political song in a pre-ideological age, before Marx has begun writing, you're reaching out for these feelings. And the joy of universal brotherhood, which I think is explicitly referred to in that throwing off of local custom, you know, the sort of nationalism has kept us apart, you know, society has kept us apart. But there is a universal spark that's in the Ode to Joy that they're talking about that brings them together, that overcomes these old ideas, and we throw off these old ideas. And you've got to remember, the Ode to Joy first found its popularity as a drinking song. Before Beethoven put this particular tune to it, it was quite a common drinking song. And it's that way it became radical. The radical clubs who were coming together, you know, they weren't only coming together to change the world, they were also coming together to you know, have a few beers and talk about politics, as people do. And I think that's the context in which the Ode to Joy first took on its own life away from Schiller, and Beethoven picked up on it in through that way.
So it picks in, it also sort of clicks into a kind of revolutionary wave that's wider than any one writer or thinker at that
but
time.
But in the sense that it's a revolutionary wave in a non-ideological sense. Now, we tend to see our politics through the Marxist language that became the lingua franca of politics in the 20th century. But if you look at the French Revolution, if you look at the English Revolution of the 1640s, they're not talking in an ideological language in the strict sense. They're trying to find a language for the levelers. They're looking to the Bible, and for the French revolutionaries, the American revolutionaries, they're looking to the ideas of the Enlightenment, because they haven't yet formed that ideological language that we now use.
It's worth just reminding, you don't need reminding, but we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. The social order anywhere in Germany absolutely forbade that. There was no possibility whatsoever in the social order in Germany in Schiller's day, in Hölderlin's day, in Hegel's day, of that coming about. We hold these truths to be self-evident. You can't actually take that back. Once that has been said and put into currency, it is actually there forever, no matter how vilely it gets travestied and how totally it gets crushed, and with the effort in Germany between 33 and 45, actually the effort to annihilate it. Once it's out and it is then current, it's never actually able to be retracted.
And that's the key revolutionary idea of the American Revolution. This space, this new world, is going to be different from the old world. But they were stuck with this. I mean, by the time Beethoven is writing the Ninth Symphony, the idea of the revolution of the French and American revolutions is kind of washed out.
Billy, it's clearly that you've thought very long, very hard and very deep about this particular poem. And that's perhaps not surprising, because just a few years ago, you were actually asked, commissioned, to write your own version of the Ode to Joy. Could you tell us a bit about how that came about and what you did with that commission?
I mean, I was taking part in the celebrations for the reopening of the Royal Festival Hall in London a few years ago. And I was asked to do something called the Big Busk, where I was calling people to come to the festival hall, bring their acoustic guitars, and we'd sing some old busking songs together. In one of the planning meetings, they were discussing the performance. The whole event would end with a full performance of the last movement of the Ninth Symphony with choristers from all around, amateur choristers from all around Britain in the Royal Festival Hall, in the stalls. So many of them, they were actually in the stalls with one of the festival hall symphonies. And there were also the children from Lambeth schools were going to sing the Ode to Joy in their concerts. They did four concerts over the weekend. So I said, well, you know, I'll do it in the Big Busk. It's only two chords. It's really easy to play. And someone said, do you know the German words? I said, I'll just write a couple of verses myself. So why not? So I did write a couple of verses, and the choir mistress who was teaching the kids said to me, would it be possible for the kids to use your verses, because frankly they're having a real trouble with the literal translation. I think that's one of the things that makes it difficult for us in English to get to grips with the spirit of this, is the Daughters of Elysium. I don't even know where Elysium is, and it doesn't really rhyme with much either on a good day. So I wrote these verses for the children to sing, and on the train on the way home, and I sent them in, and I got a phone call a few days later. Would it be possible to write the whole thing for the closing ceremony, for the closing event? And I said, well, yeah, probably. And they said, great, can we have it by Tuesday? And this was Thursday. So I had a very interesting weekend, me and Beethoven. Spent a lot of time together that weekend, walking the dog, top of the hill, singing the Ode to Joy, scribbling ideas down. And then on the Tuesday, I went to the festival hall, sat down with the Mary King, who was taking the many choirs together, and we kind of put it all together. And I'm glad we did, because it allowed me to put in the key line from the whole thing. Alle Menschen werden Brüder, all men become brothers, in the second part of my version. Because I think when people ask me, you know, is your version a translation? It's not a translation, but it is an extrapolation of that really important line. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, I didn't tell anybody in the planning from the April till the June when I performed it, because I really didn't think anyone would believe me that I was writing a new lyric for the Ode to Joy to be sung.
And for that act,
people would be saying, forget you're joking.
I think we should celebrate that act of chutzpah, Billy, by asking you if you wouldn't mind just giving a little burst of it right now.
I could sing you a little burst. Yeah, I do have my guitar. It's eminently singable. And let's see what we can do then. See now, like a phoenix rising from the rubble of the war, hope of ages manifested, peace and freedom evermore. Brothers, sisters, stand together, raise your voices now as one. Though by history divided, reconciled in unison. Mm-hmm.
history divided, reconciled in unison. Fall off now the chains of ancient bitterness and enmity. Hand in hand, let's walk together on the path of liberty. Hark, a new dawn is breaking. Raise your voices now as one. Though by history divided, reconciled in unison. Though by history divided, reconciled in unison. What's to be then, oh my brothers, sisters, what is in your hearts? Tell me now the hopes you harbor, what's the task and where to start? Though speak 10 million voices, every word is understood. Furnish every heart with joy and banish all hatred for good. Furnish every heart with joy and banish all hatred for good. Though by history divided, reconciled in unison.
There's a load more, but that's sort of basically the busker's version.
And I have to say, it would do credit either to the Royal Festival Hall or the London Underground, Billy. Behind the language of brotherhood, behind the language of unity, isn't there a rather bloodier story that's also being told?
The problem with the ode, and it's not particularly disrespectful, it's the Schillerian manner of writing poetry, unlike others, was actually to deal in abstractions. And everybody knows that abstractions in a political zone are exceedingly difficult to actually implement. And I spoke of the people of 1770, the normal course of these young men, and they were mostly men, of the generation of 1770, is through an extraordinary optimism and enthusiasm for it, then into a bitter disappointment, and they back off at different stages. But most of them, and certainly Schiller was made an honorary citizen of the French Republic, and by the time the news came to him, he long since didn't want any such thing, because after the terror of 1793, most people actually, not all by any means, had backed off. So this generation of 1770 is actually the disappointed generation. They see the thing not actually the millennium hope. And it is a millennial thinking. It's the end of the century, the feeling that 1800 would actually bring about a brotherhood, but actually a changed humanity altogether. Now, the disappointment of that is absolutely colossal. And don't tell me that disappointment is, as it were, no longer with us. Ours is a bitterly, bitterly disappointed generation as well, not in exactly the same fashion. But you see again and again and again these colossal hopes being raised by one political group or another, and then you actually see the implementation of them in something which any person thinking seriously about it must acknowledge to be disappointing.
I think Schiller in some way suffers from the age-old problem is that you can't change the world by writing songs. And it's wrong to, or plays for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, music has an opportunity to bring people together and to offer them a different perspective on something. And I think that's what you're getting with the Ninth Symphony. Beethoven, in that time of you know, great disappointment, you know, Beethoven himself was, you know, deeply disappointed that their radicalism had come to nothing, and yet he was able to put Schiller's poem, which had great had meant a great deal to the young radicals, in a setting that has immortalised it. And I think that's the real human spirit, to look into the face of disappointment as an artist, yet still to be able to find something powerful so that the audience, who in this equation are the only people who can change the world, go away inspired. That's the genius of how music plays a role in changing the world, but cannot change the world itself.
And listening to the Ninth Symphony is an equivalent of that political statement. That is to say, although not directed and although not made real, it leaves you with this, it inspires you to think that things do not necessarily have to be this bad. It necessarily induces in you again and again and again that human beings are worth more and ought to be treated better than they get treated, that there's a better social order. Now, that's not what the Ninth is actually saying in words, but the feeling of a sort of unfinished business, a sort of unresolved, not yet actually implemented idealism. And that's what you get.
The point is, though, you can't put the American Declaration of Independence to music.
No.
But what you can do...
That's a challenge.
What you can do is you can put the way it makes you feel to poetry and to music. And I think that's what the Ode to Joy does, both in its original poem by Schiller and then in its setting by Beethoven. It takes the way you feel, the joy that you feel to be alive in that morning, as Wordsworth said, and to read that there are people who are making this declaration and living that way. How does it make you feel? That, to me, is what both Schiller and Beethoven are communicating to us.
Well, joy may be unconfined, but I'm afraid this event isn't. So that's all for tonight. But many thanks to my guests, David Constantine, Peter Oswald, and Billy Bragg.
That Proms Literary Festival event was presented by Rana Mitter and produced by Allegra McElroy. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and tonight's Prom, live on BBC Radio 3, online and live too on Classical NPR. The Minnesota Orchestra is here tonight with its music director, Osmo Vanska. And the remaining work in the programme continues a long-standing Proms tradition. For many years, until the 1980s, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony was heard on the penultimate night of the season. It's now been performed here more than 70 times in total. Now, Osmo Vanska has become a major Beethoven specialist in the past few years, and he's masterminded an acclaimed symphony cycle with the Minnesota Players. I asked him whether it had been a daunting experience to reinterpret all these great works.
It's a huge challenge if you are going to do nowadays cycle of Beethoven symphonies, because every orchestra, every conductor have done it. It must be so good that people are not going to complain, why did you do it? There is nothing new. And also, those fresh and new kind of things, they should be part of music. If I try to be different, that's a terrible reason to do music. So, brief way to say my feelings about music of Beethoven. I just love that music, and when we start to play, I think I can live that, and I try to express my emotional and practical feelings, and it comes all together. It's a music about life.
Osmo Vanska talking to me earlier. His feelings for the symphonies and indeed the music in total of Beethoven. Well, Brian Newhouse is with me. Brian, you know these Minnesota Players as well as anybody, I guess, and you've watched Osmo Vanska develop his love of Beethoven with the orchestra and go through this symphony cycle. It's been quite a journey for them, hasn't it?
Yeah, they like any orchestra, gets used to listening to recordings of Beethoven symphonies, having different conductors come through, guest conductors. And the surprise for them when Osmo came in 2003 was that he laid the score of Beethoven down on the podium and essentially said, "This is the Bible. We are not going to take the established wisdom of tradition of recordings. We're going to follow what this man wrote on the page in its very particular moment." And that was a surprise and made for some very fresh performances, people hearing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or the Ninth Symphony as if for the first time. And then they started making these recordings, and critics started saying the same thing, and audiences started snapping these up saying, this is some of the finest Beethoven we've ever heard. And it's just what the man wrote on the page.
And that's a tradition, really, that Osmo was saying to me earlier. He's carried on from his days in Finland with the Lahti Symphony Orchestra, with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and now with the Minnesota Orchestra. And as I speak, they're being joined by tonight's soloist, the soprano Helena Juntunen, the mezzo Charlotte Hellekant, the tenor Eric Cutler, and the bass Neil Davis. The BBC Symphony Chorus are on stage as the soloists take their position, slightly elevated to the back of the stage here, just in front of the chorus. And here's Osmo Vanska on the podium to conduct.
Thank you. Thank you. Stimmen.
Joy in time.
Beethoven's epic journey from darkness into a great blaze of light in his Ninth Symphony. The Minnesota Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska, with soloists Helena Juntunen, Charlotte Hellekant, Eric Cutler, Neil Davis, and the BBC Symphony Chorus. Brian Newhouse, who's been drinking all that in with me. Brian, Osmo Vanska on the platform, he lives every single moment, and he's one of the most athletic of conductors you'll ever see.
Especially in the last movement, I think he touched down on the podium about three times. He spends a lot of time airborne.
Just as well he's a bit of a fitness fanatic.
You often see him around Minneapolis riding his bicycle and jogging, and that all comes in handy in the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth. Well, listen to him go here.
Great cheer for our four vocal soloists here. And I know at least one of them, Helena Juntunen, has been taking part in the symphony cycle in Minnesota with Osmo Vanska. It's all part of this sort of family feeling that he's really developing.
Yeah, he has his pick of soloists, and he really knows who he wants to tap for this performance of Beethoven's Ninth, and these were handpicked by Osmo. You're going to make the trip to London with us in Minnesota to show them the very best.
And of course, you know, you have a great tradition of concert giving and indeed broadcasting. And in fact, your history of broadcast goes back almost 90 years, which is extraordinary.
The Minnesota Orchestra has been on the air for a long time, even before it was called the Minneapolis Symphony, and changed its name in the 1960s. And we are very pleased and honored to be the broadcast partner. Every one of their Friday night subscription concerts is broadcast live across classical Minnesota Public Radio's region in the upper Midwest. A real thrill for us.
And I believe your colleagues back home and your listeners are hearing this in surround sound, which must be quite an experience for them.
If the fingers are crossed that the technology is working for us, this is a bit of an experiment, and we hope it does.
Let's hope it came.
And if they did, they're getting the thrill of being immersed in 5,500 people on their feet right now, cheering for the principals, Basil Reeve, oboe, Michael Gast, horn, Sarah Kwok, acting concertmaster. All of these had delicious little solos in the course of the ninth, and all getting their share of the applause right now.
And of course, Osmo Vanska, as you mentioned earlier, he did start out as an orchestral player himself, so he knows exactly what it's like to be right in the middle of all of this as a member of the ensemble.
Yeah, and he pays special attention. I think if Bert Hara, the principal clarinetist, weren't as good as he is, his life would be miserable, I think, because Osmo knows from the inside out how those solos are to be played on clarinet.
We've got David Temple coming on stage now. He's taken on the job of chorus master for tonight in his day job, I suppose you might say. He's the music director of the Crouch End Festival Chorus, but he's drilled the BBC Symphony Chorus tonight. And the fourth of their five proms, this is, I should say. They're back, of course, on the last night. And they rise to their feet for another bow with the soloists and the whole orchestra now. A great experience for them, Brian. I hope they'll go back home with good memories of this prom season.
Oh, my. And I have to give credit where it's due here. You know, it's a rare thing to see and hear a chorus perform the last movement of Beethoven's Ninth without a piece of music in front of them. All of you listening, and whether in the BBC or back in the States, this is done from memory. And that's a lot of Schiller's text to commit to memory, and hats off to the BBC Symphony Chorus for that.
Well, hats off to you as well, Brian, and great pleasure to have you with me in the Loterbox tonight, and I hope to see you again at another prom season. I should tell you, tomorrow night, the Czech Philharmonic will be here with Sir John Eliot Gardner, and they have an all-Czech programme. Music, well, not quite all-Czech, I should say, Dvořák, Martinů, Janáček, and some Grieg as well. But Osmo Vanska coming back on stage, and these cheers and stamping and applause are going to carry on. I'll leave you with that sound. Brian and I will say goodnight and hand you back to Broadcasting House and to Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much, Penny. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday, the 6th of September at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. And if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then you can by visiting bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. You can also hear that concert again on the BBC iPlayer for the next 7 days. If you go to that proms website, or indeed to the Radio 3 website, then click on iPlayer at the top of the screen and that'll get you there.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, coming up next this evening, our play in the Wire season. It's called The Gold Farmer, and that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. And it's followed by Here and Now, a concert of recent works by Scottish and Irish composers, given in June at the City Halls in Glasgow, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ilan Volkov. We'll be hearing music by Martin Suckling, James Clapperton, David Fennessy, David Horn, and also we'll hear a piece by Jonathan Harvey called Speakings. That's all in Here and Now at 10:30. And it's followed at midnight by The Early Music Show, presented this week by Robert Hollingworth. He explores Monteverdi's fourth book of madrigals from 1603. So if you're somebody who stays awake till midnight, you might like to hear that. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 10:15. And now in The Wire, another chance to hear The Gold Farmer by Alan Harris. Rory Kinnear stars in a dark fantasy about two men striving to be warriors in an atomised world. The play contains strong language.
I feel like I have a full bladder and there's no toilet in sight. No, it's wrong. Don't talk about feelings. Here and now, Terry. OK. Right. Hello, hello. Mary had a little lamb. What do you say? What one's supposed to? Wednesday, February 10th, 1816, GMT. Can you hear that? Next door but one. Throwing fag ends over the balcony. Thinks no one can see her. Net curtains. Not just for old people. And from my computer room, I can see along the balcony that runs along the flat. I'm on the end. Third floor. Double glazing. Good locks. Grange down. Asian fella, next door. He's in a rush. And smoking. And gone. Seen him working in Barry's International Supermarket on the ground floor. Not his flat. Barry of Barry's International Supermarket told me when I moved in. Old council tenant subletting to Chinese and Somalis and Iranians and renting fancy ones down the bay.
Cardiff Bay.
She's going back in. I think her name's Brenda. All she listens to is Cliff Richard.
This isn't hard. Not too hard. Oh, sound normal.
Hey, Torque. Torque Thunderbolt, you there, dude?
In position.
This ain't gonna be no Leroy. Numbers, Elric. 66.6. Recurring, of course.
Liking them numbers.
I'll put down shouts. Ignore small stuff. It's Baz Rudin we're after, agreed?
Agreed.
Right. Some eggs when we enter, put down shots and spells. Go for Baz Rudin, right? Let's do it!
Whoa!
Sorry!
Say it again.
Sorry.
Say it again.
Sorry.
Say it again.
Sorry.
Say it again.
Oh, sorry.
Say it again.
Sorry for being late, Barry.
Multiplying.
Shout. Put it down. Out of shout. Cut. Put down shout. Cut.
They're multiplying. Ah! 1804 GMT, Friday, February 12th. Is this what I should be doing? Is this helping? I feel like a right twat.
Drinking on your own.
Who's that?
It's me, buddy.
Greyhawk?
Your team chat is on again.
What can I say?
You can say, Greyhawk, it's good to see you.
Oh, as always, buddy. New cloak?
Dragon skin.
You good?
I've been better. Asshole of boss.
Hearing you. Same the world over.
Have to return 10 minutes. Double shift. Any big kill?
Got roasted by Baz Rudin.
Level 58 sucks, Greyhawk.
Go up level soon.
Having doubts.
Hang in there, buddy.
It's easier to start again.
Scrap talk, Thunderbolt. You one of the good guys. Have another ale.
To honor.
To glory.
To warriors.
How did Basrutin defeat you?
Fire. Cone effect. A gold farmer will kill Basrutin and loot him. I hate gold farmers.
Some goodness in everyone, Tom.
You're too generous, Greyhawk. Gold farmers have no honour.
Have to go soon.
Should only allow warrior, wizard and cleric classes in the kingdom.
Utopia.
No tiredness in a warlock's eyes.
Paladin never looks you up and down and shakes his head. We the masters.
Not the servants.
To
warriors.
So, who are you speaking to?
Ah, just being stupid. I'm keeping a journal. Oh, no, it's...
You crack me up, buddy!
It's Olympus Digital Voice Recorder, VN4100, 3299 Curries. Record on the go, play it back. See if I sound normal. When I finished at my last job, I got things a bit, out of proportion, and, they sent me to this woman who said it would help just put down all my thoughts, keep them in a safe place. This woman said, just record stuff, no matter what, in the here and now, in proportion. And, play it back. She said, if I sound normal, probably am normal. It's called self-awareness therapy. You have to just pick a special person, and then one day, if you feel confident, you play them the recordings. You listen to them together.
Record this?
Yeah.
Must be nice.
I feel a bit stupid.
To have girlfriend to record stuff for. You play her this? Tell her about me?
The woman said I should just record normal stuff. Friends and shit.
I have. Sword of Crop.
No way.
I win it. I think my friend Torp need this.
That's amazing.
But...
What?
Embarrassing.
What?
Cannot give you Sword of Croc. Worth 30,000 gold.
One sec. Well, even warriors have needs. It's only right you should get a reward, but... I'm not that... Where you live, you might think we're all... I've just started a new job as a clerk. 5 months, on probation, really. It's a smaller firm, just me and Henry and Heather in a room with one window. Trillian works in a different room.
You cool guy. Wish I could give you Sword of Croc. Mother has bad eyes. Cataract.
Oh, sorry.
What Trillian like?
She always smells of flowers. She never takes the piss. She understands it takes time to build a character. She assumes I like Star Trek, but I don't. I hate it. It's too moralistic.
That hurt.
Who?
Girlfriend. Trillian at the door. What's her real name?
I've got to go, Greyhawk. Logging off. Sorry to hear about your mum.
Hang in there, buddy. Meet next Saturday here at Tavern 2330 GMT for ale and chat. Think about Sword.
I'm here, Sal. Do you like noodles?
Hello to you too, Teddy.
You do like noodles?
Can I come in?
Can we just... Oh, what's that?
Olympus Digital Voice Recorder, VN4100, 3299, Curries. Record on the go.
Right. Make a start, yeah? Here you go. The peoples of Tantara has always believed that life is most important. That life is the greatest gift that we could ever be given. We love life so much. Teddy.
Oh, this is taking the piss.
Sorry. On time tomorrow. Delayed in Kingdom of Dragons.
I ain't in the mood. Get stuck in.
And Teddy, and?
And the troubles you now face.
You speak the truth. Life is everything to the people of Tantara. Yet
you sacrifice a young boy.
We has no choice.
I pray for 8 hours when I leave here. And all
addiction
day...
Addiction takes many forms, child. I had a cousin in Splott who was addicted to watching planes fly overhead.
I'm not addicted.
Always looking up.
Need money to send home to mother.
Gave him sort of a haughty look.
Like living in two worlds, here and Kingdom of Dragons.
He moved to Heathrow.
I'm a gold farmer.
You're taking the piss.
I'm no piss taker.
Never knows with you lot.
What you mean, you lot?
Employees.
You don't have to know every part.
Well, Marcus said a good actor can anticipate better when he or she knows the whole.
There is no other way.
Not unless you take his place.
I bought noodles.
Who'd have thunk it? Me, acting. Oh, if Jeff could see me now, he knows what he'd say.
We should eat.
I was arsing about.
Only 5 days to the reading. Can't wait to see you in it.
Oh, it's nice to have a friend whose world doesn't revolve around drinking. Thanks for helping me with the script, Terry. When Marcus said we're doing a play based on Star Trek, I thought, oh, God, no. Couldn't believe it when you turned up at Fisher and Tate's. Never thought you'd leave Milton Keynes. I thought if anyone can help, Terry can. I remembered from uni you was always into all that.
Yeah.
Thank you. You won't remember this, but after class once, I remember some of the rugby lads had put Sandra's bag on top of the lockers. I remember her sitting there in a wheelchair trying to reach it as they pretend to laugh at something else. I remember seeing you walk over, take the bag down, hand it to Sandra and walk off. I never did nothing. You've a good heart, Teddy Marshall.
One of the good guys.
Finish this bit and I better get back. Perils of living with your parents.
Okay. No, sir, I haven't the strength.
I believe there is strength in you, James T. Kirk.
Do you know what the T stands for? Ticklish?
Oh, no, Teddy, no!
Saturday, February 13th, 1452 GMT. Sunny. Again. Wonder if Sally likes the sun. After working for just 5 months, I've saved £2,018.
For a poxy imaginary sword, £2,000.
It's sword of crop.
I'd flog it. Sharp.
Cannot. Set up as gold farmer by boss. He give computer. We all linked. Like franchise. Everything I earn go to boss's clearing house. All the gold I mine, all object I find or win, I declare and he take a cut.
Except this sword.
It's sword of Crockberry.
You can't advertise you've got it because you nicked it. Where is it, this sword?
I bury it. Deep in my hard drive. I take it out of the game. On computer at home where boss never find it. Hidden so well, not even FBI could find it. But I think I have private buyer for sword. My friend, Torque Thunderbolt.
Unique. Formed from the blood of Onyxia. Forged in the ancient fire pools of Qua.
Agility.
Plus 90. Stamina plus 98.
Strike rate.
Improved by 62%, 600 DPS, non-elemental, bind on touch, 350 durability, create fire of magua on impact, increase defense plus 18, improve haste rating by 72%. Whoever wield it, invincible, sword of crop.
Oh, well, I can't afford it, but lucky you got it before a gold farmer. Way of the world.
Used to be better before they banned bots to do digging.
No, there's no honour in robots.
No honour in 8-year-old boy working 18-hour day either. Tapping away a computer to dig for gold. No honour in bosses selling gold to Western Gamer and making millions of dollars while farmer get $1 a day.
Yeah, I suppose not.
But time's money, Greyhawk.
Monday, February 15th, 02:44. I'm looking at a curious image. A moonbeam is hitting my samurai sword, coming right through the net curtains to the point where it's mounted above my PC. Cost me £106 on the internet. I told my work colleagues about it at the last place I worked, Milton Keynes' premier industrial accident solicitors. They'd seen Kill Bill. Dawn asked if it's a present for someone. Have I bought my girlfriend a samurai sword for Valentine's? I say no. I bought it because it's an object of great beauty. And anyway, if I want to buy someone something, it doesn't have to be on some special day that Clinton Cards has made up. James starts doing an impression of me with a sword, and Dawn laughs a lot. And I laugh a bit, because we're supposed to be filing. And James says, "Are you like Monkey, Terry? Terry's like Monkey from Monkey," and Dawn joins in. "You're a samurai, Terry, like the guy from Monkey, the monkey from Monkey. Remember Monkey? Terry's like Monkey from Monkey. He's a samurai." And I'm so close to Dawn's face, and I want to say, he was not a samurai. He was a fallen god. But I don't. And I'm thinking, what a lot of makeup you have on, Dawn. Close up, I can see the pits in your skin. Not so perfect close up. Tuesday, 20:08 GMT. Blood elves show no mercy. I'm searching for him. But Sally's on her way.
Oh, sorry, it burned.
No. Yes, ow.
Oh, here, let me your blouse. Oh, coffee all over your blouse. Oh, let me.
It's okay. Oh, shit.
I have sponge inside, water in case it burns or stain. I'm not mad axe murderer. Not on Tuesdays anyway. You recognize me? Ciao. I work in Barry's International Supermarket downstairs. Oh, please, I feel bad.
I'm only going next door, to Terry's.
Who?
Next door, Terry.
No, don't know.
Browner, so I worked with him. Harmless.
Not like me.
No.
I feel bad. Come in. I have ancient Chinese remedy for coffee stain.
Yeah?
It's called Silit Bang.
The same pattern, death after death. In the garden, waiting for me. Talk Thunderbolt. There's a small hedge. And on the other side, people go about their daily business. The merchants, the mages, the elves, the ironmongers, the clerics, the ones on a quest, and the ones without honour. It doesn't look like death. It's just sleeping, waiting. Maybe the sword of crop would have made a difference. Maybe
Daddy,
if I...
you in there? Oh, I had an accident. Ran into your neighbour. Coffee. My fault.
I was killed again. Talk waited for me in the garden.
Right. Lovely fella, Chow. You knows him?
That a new T-shirt?
No, it's Chow's. Borrowed it. Cool, yeah? Trendy. And my blouse is in my bag. Stain wouldn't come out, so... I told him about the reading. I said he might come. Oh. Thanks for letting me here. Mum and Dad are really getting on my tits. I should never have moved back in after me and Jeff split up.
You should move in.
What?
You know, I have a spare room. Bills aren't much. It's good for the shops.
I don't think working together and being flatmates would really...
Joke.
I complain about my mum and Dad, but you know, they're all
right. I'm joking, Sally. I think we would make good...
flatmates, actually.
If I ever get a different job, then we could think... Yeah. We'll go together, yeah? To the reading.
Mm.
I'll call around tomorrow on the way. Yeah?
Mm.
I'm taking tomorrow off to rehearse.
Oh, I've got a meeting with old man Tate tomorrow.
We should get on.
Later we could watch a DVD.
Oh, I'm meeting Marcus and the gang at the Vic Park.
Tropic Thunder.
You're welcome.
Go away.
Shut the
door.
I need extra shift. My mother...
Is Dmitri or Ashkan us? I say, yeah. You're a good worker, Dmitri or Ashkan, depending. You turns up on time. You don't steal and don't fall asleep at the till. You understand, Chow? Comprendi?
I do not steal.
I thought this sword was valuable.
It should go to right person.
Mighty warrior want to keep all the cash.
I am not warrior, only gold farmer.
Can't you just wave your magic wand? Or sprinkle some fairy dust and make Mammy's eyes better?
I am powerful, but cannot do that.
Powerful?
I may be no warrior, but I level 80, Barry. No one more powerful than me. I want powerful gold farmer.
You'll never be a warrior. Once a shit shoveler, always a shit shoveler. Once a gold digger,
farmer.
Always a gold farmer. And there's nothing you can do to change that.
They shouldn't be long. You like them. Marcus is a bit overbearing, but... I said I asked this workmate who loves Star Trek and is into all that, and they wanted to pick your brains. Horrible phrase, that, isn't it? Oh, my bag.
What?
It's open. I never opened it. Oh, God. My phone. He was on top. It's not... Oh, it must be... Oh, my phone's gone missing.
You're sure, it might be.
The zip was closed, I swear. Well,
maybe you left it in...
Oh, that fella there.
What?
He was sitting just here. Why has he moved?
He was talking to his mate.
He took it.
You don't...
I swear, Daddy, he was looking. I had a feeling I did. When I went to the toilet, did you see him do anything?
No.
I'm going to ask him.
No, what, accuse him?
Ask him?
Excuse me, you've stolen my phone.
I'm going to just...
No, wait. I'll go. He hasn't got it.
What did he say?
He hasn't.
What did you say?
I said, excuse me.
Excuse me?
I said, excuse me, and he said, you're not from round here, are you? Where are you from? And I said, none of your business. And he said, why are you here then? And I said, I live here. And he said, what do you think of Cardiff? And I said, it's all right. I said, it's all right. And just all right. Yeah, it's all right. If you don't like it, he knows what you can do. You can fuck off back to England. And I said, it's all right, apart from the phone thieves.
And?
What?
Did you ask him if he had my phone?
I think he knows where I stand.
Oh, well, couldn't you just ask him normally? I'm going to go...
No.
What?
I've asked. He hasn't got your phone.
Give me yours.
What do you want?
Here. Right. I'm ringing it.
Sally, I am telling you he hasn't got it. I could tell from his eyes that he hasn't...
See? I knows wrong again.
No, don't.
But he's got it.
You finished?
That man has got my phone.
No, he hasn't.
But I just rang it.
I'm leaving. Are you coming?
No, I'm going to wait for
the He said, and I'll quote, if you speaks to me again, I will come over and break your English fucking neck, and then I'll take your girlfriend and fuck some sense into her.
You can't just leave
finish
now.
Your drink.
People just can't go and take other people's
there,
stuff.
There, I'm done.
Well, the rest will be here soon.
I've a big day tomorrow anyway, meeting with Tate.
Did you tell him I was your girlfriend?
It's a phone. A phone. Just a phone.
My phone?
I have to go.
Oh, Teddy! Teddy!
1903 GMT, Wednesday, February 17th. Readings tonight. Everything is not normal, is it? Because I failed to notice the door to Mr. Tate's office opening and the door to Mr. Tate's office closing. Mr. Tate says there is a global recession, not just Cardiff. You're from London, way, Terry. Got to keep the old chin up. Half full, Terry, not half empty, yeah? What's the glass, Terry? You haven't fitted in, have you? Not settled. A tip. Don't surf the internet so much on the company dollar. It puts extra pressure on your colleagues. Some of them have complained. Leave your security pass with Alex at the side lodge and good luck, son. I mean that. Out of Tate's office, I look at my colleagues. Going for a vice beer, Henry? Frappuccino, Heather? Or keep in touch, Terry? And then giggling behind your stupid Heather hand. I have rules. They haven't got any rules. The rule is that if you employ someone, you should at least give them a chance. You're all living without any fucking honour.
Make a start, yeah? Peoples of Tantara has always believed life is the greatest gift. We love life so much. We love life.
The balcony. Old woman. Emptying her ashtray and bin over the balcony. Emptying any old shit over the balcony. She's gone. Chinaman. He's smoking talk. He's waiting for her, Terry. There she is. She's smiling. A blinding smile. She's stopping. I can see their lips moving.
Give us a drag.
What?
A puff on your fag. You okay?
Do you think people can change?
Sounds deep.
Not really.
I think people say they'll change. My ex, Jeff, was always saying he was going to change. He was full of shit. It's not what people says that counts, but what they do.
1916 GMT. Smoke swirling around her. Slow. Taking ages to clear. Her ruby lips touching the filter of the cigarette. The same filter his lips touched. Her saliva. Sharing a moment. Sharing a moment? Handed it back. Fingers touching. He's taken a drag. His saliva. He's going in, leaving the cigarette with her. A moment. Inhaling.
Fire pools of Qua. Whoever wields it is invincible. The sword of Croc.
I told you I couldn't afford it, Greyhawk. But I can. You'll have to wait a bit for the money. Greyhawk. I'm sorry I lied to you. Warriors don't lie.
I am Gold Farmer. I want to be warrior like you, but do not have time
you,
to...
A Gold Farmer?
Forgive me. I want to be like you. Let me explain...
Where, Gold Farmer?
Still meet every week, yeah? In the tavern.
Where, Snake?
Just talk about shit. We still friends.
Bring the sword. Saturday. 2000 GMT. The tavern. Don't cross me, Gold Farmer. I'm warning you.
I'm sorry, Tor.
...2138 GMT, Wednesday. In 3 days' time, I shall take possession of the Sword of Croc and all will be possible.
Next time she calls, she won't stop on the balcony at the Chinaman's. She'll come straight to my door. We've made sure of that.
This is Terry. I'm not here to leave a message.
Terry, I just heard. I'm so sorry. I knew Tate was having a word, but I never... I called round on the way to the reading, but... You probably weren't in the mood. I totally understand. Everyone's totally gutted. Mal in IT says they've been monitoring everyone's internet use and yours was high, and that's just... sneaky. His big brother, Terry. You should appeal or something. Everyone sends their love. The reading went fine. In fact, it was bloody brilliant, and Marcus wants to do another one based on Star Trek, and... Terry, you there?